Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And I'd like to welcome our new listeners in Seattle listening to KBFG LPFM 107.3. This spring, Oregon has the opportunity to take a major step in the transition from polluting energy to a clean energy future. The Clean Energy Jobs Bill, currently being considered by the Oregon legislature, limits climate pollution and invests in clean energy strategies that create jobs and support clean air. This morning, we talk with Oregon State Representative Karen Power and Climate Solutions Oregon Director Meredith Connolly about how the Clean Energy Jobs Bill will help determine our climate future by putting a price on carbon and investing in a clean and green economy. Karen and Meredith, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And I just have to have a disclosure. Karen is actually my state rep, so we're going to ask her some very hard questions today. Karen, who's only been in the legislature for, a year? This is going to be your second.
This is going to be my second year.
Yeah. And I understand that you have a long background in environmental work, actually, and like a degree in it and things like that.
I do. I got my JD here in town from Lewis and Clark in environmental law, and I'm still practicing in my day job as an associate general counsel for a nonprofit here.
So do you think with that environmental expertise, you'll finally be able to move the Oregon State Legislature in the right direction? But we're talking today about this Clean Energy Jobs Bill that you've been part of getting this going, right?
Well, yeah. It preceded me by many, many years.
Actually, we'll get that, how long it took. But this current version of it.
Hoping to come in at the tail end with some of my new colleagues who are all, will be in our second year and help get it over the finish line.
Well, before we get into the details of this, I've been thinking this morning, I was looking at the timeline that Mara Gross, who's the communications director at Climate Solutions, and she sent me the long and sad history of trying to get carbon pricing here in Oregon, and it goes back to 1997. I was thinking, what paradigm shifts have to happen to make this kind of change?
Well, I think what we've seen in the last year and the last couple of years is climate impacts coming home to Oregon, and that certainly has increased the urgency and has made it more concrete and real, the challenges we're facing, in a way that never before. It sounded like something far off in the future. We'll get to it, make some hard decisions, and get off of fossil fuels at some point. And now we're really seeing what happens if we don't, the price we're all paying now, and why we need to take steps to move forward now.
Well, I was thinking how summer of 2015 was the first summer I actually thought about leaving Portland. I mean, it was so extremely hot and dry and horrific, and I started thinking, well, maybe I'll move to Astoria. I thought if there's another summer like this, I can't deal with it. And that was the first summer that I thought, okay, climate change is really here. This is not something that we're getting little suggestions of it. This is the real thing. And then we had a respite. The next summer wasn't quite so bad. I decided to stay in Portland. Then last summer, I think, was really, for the planet, the summer where climate change just really hit. And after seasons of hurricanes and some other things that were really extreme, it seemed like it all came together between the fires and then the hurricanes and then what's going on now with the landslides in California. Do you think that this is enough of a wake-up call that something will happen in this legislature, Karen?
I think we're certainly starting to see the accumulation, not just of climate events, which taken in isolation in different geographies, people hope they're just one-offs, right? Because these hit us where we live, at home. And they can be extraordinarily disruptive in terms of rebuilding communities. But we're also seeing at the aggregate level costs to our national economy that we're not going to be able to bear in perpetuity. I grew up in New Jersey, right off of a river that's a tidal river, and it used to freeze when I was little. We could go climb out on it and go run around a bit. When I went back home to visit my parents for the holidays last year, the year before last, it was 65 degrees and sunny outside in New Jersey in the dead of winter. And yet, I think my parents and my community still hope that we'll go back to normal at some point in time. And we're now seeing, and I think in the aggregate, realizing that normal doesn't exist anymore in the face of climate change.
Well, actually, the Oregonian did an interesting thing. This was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. They showed the decreasing snow levels in Portland going back to about the soon after the turn of the last century. And, I mean, I came to Portland 47 years ago, and there was... I grew up in New England, so I thought there was very little snow. But it turned out that if I had been living here in the 20s or 30s, there would have been the equivalent amount of snow as there was in central New England. So it really had dropped from, like, having, I guess, an accumulation of maybe 4 to 6 feet of snow to where it's 4 to 6 inches of snow by the 80s and 90s. And when we have a big snow year like last year, now it's really an anomaly. It's an indication because the city doesn't even know how to plow anymore, and they were never very good at it by the East Coast standards. But it was definitely, I mean, it's something that I think that just looking at the snow levels and just have the Oregonian do this, and they didn't even make a comment about climate change. They just kind of put that out. So I think we're seeing that. And the other side of it, because where I grew up has been having really intensely cold mm-hmm. winters. And I think that's the other side. I mean, much even colder than when I grew up. And that's the other side of climate change. It's not just getting warmer. It's also having really erratic weather. So how does that fit into starting to make a move? I mean, maybe what we should really talk about first is what the Clean Energy Jobs Bill is about. And does it differ from all the other attempts since 1997 to get some kind of legislation passed that would put a price on carbon and actually do something concrete to limit the carbon emissions in Oregon?
Yeah, I think first I'll say I think what's different now is two things. We have had this incredible public process for a few years now, since 2015, I think, in earnest, building momentum and understanding of the not just the urgency of action and what it would do in the mechanism, but also all the opportunities it can open up. And we've had these incredible stakeholder processes with hundreds of different representatives from across Oregon and all different natural resource economies, and some of our environmental justice partners are much more engaged, labor partners, faith groups, you name it, everyone's at the table really talking through what this looks like. Our big businesses are figuring out how we can make this work for Oregon. And the other thing is we've had these types of programs in place in other states now for a number of years, and we can really look to the successes there and how they've decoupled their emissions and had their greenhouse gas emissions drop dramatically while their economies are growing, and specifically really invested in their clean energy economies and become hubs for that. Energy rates have stayed stable. We have all of those numbers and those facts on our side. Oregon likes to go first, but unfortunately, we've been beat to the punch here, and that's okay. We've seen what works, what doesn't, how to tailor this for Oregon. And so what this program really does at its simplest is it's called the Cap and Invest program because it caps our greenhouse gas emissions. Finally, our emissions right now are going up year over year since 2014. This puts a hard cap from our biggest sources of climate pollution in the state. And those biggest pollution sources now must hold permits for their climate pollution. And every year that pool of those permits, which are called allowances, gets smaller, and those are auctioned off for all of those who have to participate. And what that means is two things. That puts a price on your carbon pollution. So that means now it's not free to pollute. You have to really decide, is it less expensive to make an investment in reducing my emissions? Do I want to buy an allowance? Do I want to trade with someone who has more allowances? And so once you figure out what's the best way to comply, you seek out where those least cost emissions reductions are, and you have this long-term market signal of, okay, it's not free anymore to do this. I have to decide how to transition to a clean energy way to do things. And at the same time, those allowances are auctioned off at the state, and that generates proceeds. Those proceeds can be reinvested in the clean energy transition. And the bill and the process has done a very good job, I think, of identifying where those solutions are. So really making sure that low-income communities are held harmless. Our rural areas that are getting hit very hard by climate change are now prioritized in where the investments flow. And it really focuses on where we can generate jobs, help create a workforce pipeline, and start to make Oregon a hub for these clean energy opportunities that we see otherwise passing us by.
So what's the difference between this and just a simple carbon tax? And which one is more politically palatable?
It probably depends on where you're sitting. And I'll let Karin speak to the politics of it all. I think from an environmental perspective, this gives a hard cap on our emissions. you have no certainty with a tax. You can, you know, of course, you just increase the price on the thing you don't like, and which would be the pollution in this case. But until it got very, very high, there's no certainty that you would be actually reducing your emissions. This puts that hard cap and starts to get us down where we know at the legislature 10 years ago set a goal for where they want us to go as a state. And it's ambitious, but it's not any different than other jurisdictions under the Paris Agreement have agreed to go. And this actually gets us on that trajectory, unlike a tax.
Well, actually, I understand that Rex Tillerson is in favor of the carbon tax. I'm not sure what his position on cap and trade is. I don't know. So I'm just wondering, what are the political challenges, Karen, of either one? And why? I mean, the carbon tax seems like it's been pretty much very unpopular because it just and it can be like just badmouthed as a tax. But why do you think Rex Tillerson supports that as opposed to cap and trade?
Well, I think both market approaches were originally devised by Republicans, but different geographies and for a host of different political reasons, different constituencies within the Republican Party, I think, favor one over the other. It depends on how you approach markets. If you like a flat tax on goods to help capture the externalities there, and you like that predictability, then perhaps the carbon tax is something you favor. If you like a market-based approach where companies can trade among each other, or you can do direct investments, then the cap and invest, cap and trade systems tend to be better. We've seen Canada use both. And the reason why I think as Oregon, we've studied a number of the different systems available, cap and rebates, cap and taxes, cap and invest. California reauthorized their program this past spring on strong bipartisan lines and will extend it for beyond the next decade. We know that China is standing up their own cap and trade system this year, which will be the largest carbon market in the world. And they are discussing ways to link up with the Western Climate Initiative for Oregon. You know, we are a generally innovative state. We have a lot of opportunities for natural resource investments within a cap and invest market. I think it makes the most sense for us, and we got a report from our state agency to this effect, to link up with other states in doing this work.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, who represents the 41st District of Milwaukee and the southern end of Portland. And we're also talking with Meredith Connolly, who is the Oregon Director of Climate Solutions, which is a bi-state, I guess, organization that's been doing this stuff, basically finding solutions to the climate for a really long time. And we're talking this morning about Oregon's clean energy jobs bill, which is hopefully going to be voted on pretty soon. And you're listening here to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Well, cap and trade, I've done a few shows on cap and trade, and I've had some really excellent people explain it over the years, including other people from Climate Solutions. And I used to do this used to be a call-in show earlier in the morning, and I would get angry listeners whenever you talk about cap and trade, and they say, well, isn't that like selling indulgences? So I want to know why cap and trade, how do you distinguish cap and trade from selling indulgences? Maybe we should explain what selling indulgences
is. Right, I was going to tap into my deep Catholic school history.
Your name's Connolly, I figured you know.
Yeah, you're right. Well, you know, I think there is certainly... the devil is in the details and how you, when you put a market to work, there are certainly protections you need to put in to make sure that it is driving the change you want it to drive, and it's not just, you know, this kind of lightweight system. And I think people see where the loopholes can be, and what is different here is. When you look at climate change and what causes it and how to fix it, it's different than other pollution. You can't just put a scrubber on every car and have, you know, suddenly there aren't greenhouse gases spewing out, or every manufacturing system, every utility power plant. There are other ways to address it that may be lower cost and may actually have bigger bang for the buck from a climate perspective. But what we've seen is this system was incredibly effective when it was created to solve the acid rain problem in the Northeast. And it was a similar problem where there were many sources coming from multiple states, multiple different causes. And they didn't say each of you must reduce by X amount, because that would have been incredibly expensive and may not have gotten to the results. Everyone may have reduced by 5%. And that wouldn't have actually gotten the SOx and NOx, sulfur dioxide, and
why is that
out of the air.
Why wouldn't have that worked as well?
Well, because you couldn't say reduce by 40% each of you and have your power cost basically the same, hold the energy customers harmless, and gotten there as quickly. Instead, they said across all the sources of acid rain, you must reduce by 40%. And then they could figure out who can switch from coal to natural gas at the time, or who can then go from gas to a renewable energy plant, or make that energy efficiency investment, do more with that energy instead of having to build another power plant. All of those decisions then get rationalized into what's the least cost way to get there the quickest. And that's where a market can be successful, if you close those loopholes. And I think this bill, it's 60 pages now, and a big part of that is really learning from what works, what doesn't, how to put those protections in there and ensure that it is a successful, healthy market that actually gets to the end goals. And that's what we're starting to see in California and the 9 northeastern states who have this over their power sector, and all the other places that have put it to work as well.
So what companies and entities would be having to buy these carbon credits, basically?
So entities that emit more than 25,000 tons of carbon a year will be included within the program. We approach it slightly differently for energy utilities and consumer-owned utilities, because after years of study, we've been able to tailor this bill that's going to be before us this session to really try to keep end of, you know, power line users, our household customers, residential customers, from seeing too much of a shock in their bills to the extent that we can.
So actually, that's always a concern. Is this is going to raise prices for consumers? Is this going to raise prices for consumers?
What has been done very well, I think, through this public process is there has been a focus on how do we best transition off of fossil fuels in a way that keeps energy prices stable, holds ratepayers harmless, and really focuses on sending that price signal upstream to those who can actually make the changes. So your utility, who's deciding whether to use more fossil fuels or renewables or efficiency, how decarbonized your fuels are coming into the state, all of those decisions on the actual decision maker rather than at the actual consumer level.
Well, I'm going to have to throw in a question that's been just in the back of my mind for a long time. What about natural gas, or as people are now referring it to it as frack gas, because most of it's not very natural? I know that PGE was trying to get a couple gas generators to replace the Boardman coal fire plant, and people, so far I think they're kind of, it's on hold. But there is still, I would consider it a myth, and it's still prevalent in the Northwest, that gas is a clean alternative to coal and oil. There's a lot of people who don't think that's true, and if you look at the whole life cycle of frack gas, it's certainly, I think it's competitive with carbon, with coal in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions. So how is this bill going to interplay with the struggle that people, I know that I was at the rally last week to stop the Jordan Cove LNG terminal, and people were, you know, outside the Capitol calling on all the legislature and Kate Brown to take a stand there. What is the state's position on frack gas in terms of it being part of the energy grid? And are people listening to the concerns of a lot of environmentalists?
So I think the great thing that Oregon has done is we've already started to transition away from coal, for example. We passed in 2015 our coal to clean bill. And part of the study this past year is how to incorporate the work that we're already doing or the work that we will be doing into a cap and invest bill, so we're not double counting emissions, and we're not passing through double cost to consumers.
What does that mean by double counting and double cost?
So at times, say some of our natural gas utilities will own pipes to pass through that gas, but they're delivering it on behalf of another customer. And we want to make sure that they are not counted twice for both their own customers and then industrial customers that they may just serve as a conduit for.
So is gas being considered for the cap and trade as well? Is it seen as a fossil fuel? It's not, because that's the thing, is like, oh, it's a bridge fuel. It's okay.
Yeah, all fossil fuels are included in the program and have to hold permits for every ton of climate pollution they provide. Methane, of course, is 30 times as intense as carbon dioxide in the short term for the impact it has on heating the planet. And those methane emissions that happen in the state are reported to DEQ and are a part of the total emissions that all of these entities have to hold. Where we see some of these decisions coming down is, like, as you were referring to, PGE last year making the decision of whether to invest in another 40-year new gas plant when it was whisper-thin margins for this cost of building new wind and investing in some existing hydro contracts. And what we saw was the people of Portland very proudly standing up and saying, no, when you can make the decision to move away from fossil fuels, knowing what we know now, knowing the costs of energy storage and renewables are coming down dramatically and are now on par with these fossil fuel choices, you should not be making that 40-year investment when you can make another choice. And that's what we saw people say, and the utility respond to very quickly and shift away from that. And once you have this price on carbon and these, right now, all of those costs are externalized. So we all pay for the cost of fossil fuel burning with our health, with the impacts of climate change. And what we would like to see is those costs internalized into those decisions moving forward. So when you're truly putting them apples to apples, a new gas plant or investing in more energy efficiency and maybe making that investment in storage, we want that cost of carbon to be a part of that economic equation and in other fossil fuel infrastructure as well.
So let's talk for a moment about what's going to go on down there in Coos Bay or in Coos County if the Jordan Cove LNG terminal is built. Will they be charged? Because what I understand is it would be like 20% of Oregon's entire carbon footprint or greenhouse gas footprint would come out of, I mean, this, it would be the equivalent right now that they would produce down there of 20% of what we have. So it's a huge chunk of what is even would be allowable by state law. So how are there any mechanisms that would really disincentivize, now it's Pembina, that company we've been through with before, that would help to encourage them to not invest and to pull away from building Jordan Cove?
The program doesn't focus on any given project. It really tries to offer that long-term market signal that you must pay for your carbon pollution. So if a Jordan Cove project was built, they would have to hold a permit for every ton of pollution that they produce in the state of Oregon. And so that is part of the economics that would have to be considered in that kind of a project.
So I guess with that, because this, well, not as much in Oregon as there is in Washington, but there's just a huge amount of pressure right now to build these LNG and propane and methanol facilities. Do you think that cap and trade, and if Washington State could also get their act together and pass cap and trade or whatever they're going to, I think that's what they're also talking about doing there. Would that perhaps shift this focus that fossil fuel companies have on the Northwest and maybe sort of liberate our communities from having these battles continually?
Well, we're very proud of the green wall that we're building on the West Coast, but we are up against the federal government and the economics of international fossil fuel companies. And I think what we're seeing is, as you see, even China, Mexico is also adopting a cap and trade program. All of these countries are starting to also recognize the impacts, especially air pollution impacts that fossil fuels are having on their local communities, and looking for ways to move away as well. And I think this transition in general, we hope will be widely held, but Again, this program is not a silver bullet for all of our climate pollution. We see really great programs that are focused on getting our renewables up to 50%, getting coal out of our electricity mix, decreasing the carbon in our intensity of our fuels. All of that works together to really get our state where we need to go and make sure that we're generating these clean energy jobs so that more of our energy can come from within Oregon and can be much cleaner.
So how does the actual cap and trade work? I mean, how does the cap work in terms of actually decreasing, I would hope in a rather relatively short time, the amount of greenhouse gases that are being emitted?
So we know that we're not on track to meet our current greenhouse gas reduction goals. We made some pretty significant changes to the bill over this past year, and it differs quite a bit from previous versions that have been introduced. I think some of the biggest changes are there going to be two points of oversight for the for standing up the program, and the actual process of setting up the auction, linking up with WCI, is going to happen in 2 to 3 years. We're going to go through a rulemaking process to determine a lot of the finer points and details in this program and to stand it up, which will incorporate a lot of community feedback and stakeholder feedback along the way. But if we're able to pass it this year, it will do two things. One, we're going to hopefully form a legislative council on climate to legislative committee on climate to oversee implementation of the bill over a couple of years. I think there's a lot of policy decisions that we want our elected officials to help guide and craft in a good way. And the second is there were a number of different stakeholder committees and community committees under previous versions of the bills, and I think they just kept on getting added and added and added. It's not a really streamlined way to get community and effective feedback.
So what do you mean by stakeholder committees?
Well, I think there were 6 different committees, if I remember, proposed under the 2017 version of the bill. And talking with some of my colleagues, we want to really engage people in how do we transition into a cleaner energy future. But from thinking through how to effectively govern a program with that number of people in the room, it just wasn't going to work. And it was a duplicative, and I think a lot to ask of people's time if it wasn't going to be particularly efficient. So the larger stakeholder committee that's coming out of this will be a 21-person committee to help guide some of the policy and funding decisions. And it will engage people both from the regulated entities and the tribal interests, a number of folks from the environmental justice communities and other key constituencies, so that as we as legislators are getting great feedback from the folks who are policy experts and experts within their communities as we move forward over the next couple of years.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about Oregon's upcoming and hopefully soon to be passed Clean Energy Jobs Bill, and my guests are Climate Solutions Oregon Director Meredith Connolly and Karen Power, who's the Oregon State Representative for District 41, who you just heard speaking. And one of the things I noticed is that there's definitely a change in the title of this bill. Last year was the first year that the bill had jobs in it. Is there a reason for changing the language? Because I think in before it had more of a lofty climate justice, visual, you know, save the world kind of thing. And this is, now we're talking about jobs. So how much of that is strategic and how much of that is like, just, it really is about jobs?
I think part of Climate Solutions is part of the Renew Oregon Coalition, who has, 700 businesses have signed up in support of this bill and the efforts here. And we have organizations from across Oregon who are a part of this effort. And what we really felt like needed to be a statement is, what's the end goal here? Instead of putting a price on pollution is the way to get there, it's not the end all be all. You put a price on pollution so that you can start to internalize those costs of climate pollution, but then also generate those proceeds to reinvest into the clean energy economy. And what we know is the clean energy jobs generate 11 times the growth rate here in Oregon in solar and wind as all other jobs. So this is where we see real opportunity for Oregon and where we want there to be a focus in how do we really make that meaningful. And especially, I think what this has done a good job of as a bill and as a process is our legislators have been very focused on making sure that this truly can drive reinvestment and job creation in the rural parts of Oregon. This is not an urban Portland priority and program that you would see. This is really about making sure that these areas that have not seen new investment, as timber dollars dry up and all of these other shifts happen for the Ottoman, manufacturing trends moving out of the country, all of that, we need new reinvestment and we need it in these sustainable jobs that cannot be outsourced.
So how is this bill going to actually create jobs?
A few ways. Would you like to speak to that?
Sure.
This is Karen who's talking right now.
Okay. Yeah, no, thank you. I think our hope is, as Meredith was talking about, transitioning to cleaner ways to generate electricity and other needs that we have in running about in our daily lives. But it's also about how to use other resources more efficiently and how to get from point A to point B more efficiently. This past year, I think, was the first year that the transportation sector exceeded the utility sector in carbon emissions. So that's a pretty big shift. Transportation's a harder sector to tackle, to really get in and start driving solutions to reduce carbon emissions there.
Since we're all part of the transportation problem.
Right. And people are moving to cities. So part of the work that we'll be able to do within these market mechanisms is generate investments in more efficient ways to get around, whether that's investments in transit-oriented communities and help to provide some of the infrastructure to build housing and jobs closer into places so people don't have to sit in their cars as long, to drive investments in cleaner fuels, in charging stations, in really the systems that we're going to need to live more sustainably that are a little bit more amorphous and that government really hasn't had a traditional way of funding in a ongoing basis.
Well, I'm just thinking about a dinner conversation I was part of in Saturday night where people were complaining about our neighborhood Selwood, which is getting a lot of density mm-hmm. built in and a lot of infill. And most of the people were complaining about, losing our neighborhood feel and the old things. I mean, somebody was mourning about Dairy Queen closing. So I think there's a lot of sentimentality involved. And mm-hmm. one person said, but if we aren't going to just have sprawl, we have to build basically transit-oriented development along the corridors like Milwaukee Avenue. And it was interesting to hear him say that as his wife was saying something totally the opposite and thinking, well, this is a mindset. And I mean, I said something that, might have been completely blasphemous. I said, well, I kind of like the development on Division Street because that was what it was being compared to. Like, you're not supposed to like that stuff. But it's like, I think that part, and I wonder if there's an educational component that could be funded by this to get people to understand. I mean, there's two parts to it. This is to help people understand why we need some of the development that's happening. We also need to have some design elements in that development so that they're sensitive to the neighborhoods. And so... Because I think what we really need to be looking at is how do we transition from a car-oriented, built-for-cars community, which what Portland basically is, to a community that can really be serviced by mass transit. Because in Selwood, I mean, it's a three-quarter of a mile walk to the MAX line from my house. This is not New York City, where, usually the furthest I ever lived from a subway was six blocks. So I think that there's a lot of rethinking about that, and I wonder how that feeds into this bill.
Well, I think we can geek out for a minute about Oregon's role, I think, writ large in the future of climate change. The tension that we even feel, and I live in Milwaukee, it's that push-pull where you know intellectually that this is how humans are going to have to live more sustainably within cities. And the pull in seeing your community, which you've grown accustomed to, and love quaint small things about, things that make it feel like home to you, are changing, are going to have to change rapidly. And that is climate change. I mean, we are seeing days of smog and fire and smoke in Portland. And that's, you know, a front and center wake up call for us to say, this is going to be hard. It's gonna hit us in our hearts a little bit. But Oregon has, because of our more temperate climate and the fact that we're not seeing the same kind of crazy weather shifts in other parts of the country, you know, some of the economists we've had come in and talk to us as legislators have talked to us about the fact that, you know, the southeast of the United States is going to become really difficult to run manufacturing in the next 100 years. It's going to get too hot for various different processes.
And parts of it are going to be underwater.
Yeah. We are going to become a climate refuge for a number of different folks who can't breathe in those areas, who are looking for more stable places to do business. And that means the influx that we've seen, where it's, I think, within Portland has really made us struggle with what kind of grown-up city do we want to become. Those conversations are going to become more acute. But there's a lot of opportunity there, you know?
Yeah, actually, let's talk a little bit about that opportunity, because, I mean, I'm thinking about Milwaukee, which I was thinking, well, people, I actually have friends who moved from Selwood to Milwaukee, and they like it because it's quieter, and of course they have to drive everywhere, and there's, I look at it and go, I wouldn't really want to live here, because the things that I value the most are being able to walk to just about everything I need. How do we envision where we want to live? How do we make a connection between the values of, like, the kind of small town is? I mean, one of Portland's appeals is it's a bunch of small towns strung together with a pretty small downtown, and so you don't really feel like you're living in a big city. And I still don't feel like Division Street is a big city. So but that's because I come from a different place many years ago and have a different set of what's big. But how do we get people to appreciate? But part of it, how do we continue to build in a way that still embodies the small town spirit that I think which makes Portland be so livable and such a wonderful place to live?
I think it's a whole host of solutions and careful work to make that true. But I do think that is the struggle and the tension, and then of course there's the additional tension of neighborhoods are now valuable that weren't before, and we see this mass gentrification and unaffordability crisis happening, and people having to move out altogether of the city. And especially there's this disparity with your income level and communities of color having that upheaval. And that's something we need to grapple with as a city if we want to be the kind of place that is welcoming and affordable for everyone. I do think there is also, I hear a lot about kind of the millennial shift of really valuing that walkable community, not wanting that car dependent kind of organization of a city. And so I think there will be a trend towards how do we create probably more divisions and more where you have you can walk and bike and safely take transit. Where you need to go and you don't need as much space, and you know there are different, hopefully there are different neighborhoods and models that will accommodate all different types of what people like. But I'm not an urban planner personally, so I can't talk to all of the solutions. But what I know is, as Karin said, we're facing, you know, mass change here in Portland, whether we like it or not, and there's a good way to do it and an inclusive way to do it that can address a lot of these concerns, or it can be a hodgepodge. And Southwest has a lot of big trees and is lovely, but an unplanned kind of all over the place look to it. And I think we've seen different ways of approaching it, and we know where we need to go. It's just how we get there. And something like the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, being able to start to send that kind of rational economy-wide, we are getting off of fossil fuels and we're doing it in a way that supports communities and invests in the communities to actually be able to pay to get where we need to go. That's what is very attractive about doing it. And the longer we wait to do something like this, the more expensive it gets to make those changes. And that's the other part of the urgency here.
Well, I'm thinking actually, you know, in terms of this, I know none of us are urban planners, so this is just kind of talking off the top of my head. But like, I think about Division Street, my big I have two big gripes about Division Street. One is it's not affordable. I mean, housing is not. They took low-income housing out and put in very expensive housing. Mm-hmm. And in that area that's been developed, there's no grocery store. There's no hardware store. There's no post office. I mean, there's all the things that make Selwood. We've lost our bookstore, unfortunately. But there's... in Selwood, there is almost everything you need within a walking distance. And I look at what's going on in Division Street, and it's like restaurant after restaurant after bar after bar. It's not a place where people can really get their daily needs met.
Right. And the lines at Pock Pock are so long that you can't. Yeah. And you need a grocery store.
Right.
There's one down on 17th. I used to live not too far from there before it began to gentrify.
Well, this new season's is at 20th. Mm-hmm.
And there's another hardware store, I think, closer up to 50th.
Yeah.
I mean, that is... Our corridors and close-in areas are by necessity going to need to accommodate more people, and we've seen a lot of activity there. And I think we'll continue to see activity around our major transit corridors around the region. I think the opportunity here, and I want to build off of something Meredith said, was it's not just millennials who are choosing different modes of housing and different modes of transportation. It's going to be our second largest population, baby boomers. As they're aging and are maybe getting rid of their cars, we're going to need to be able to accommodate a number of different age groups and being able to walk and get transit to the places that they need to get services. And we've been able to do some incremental funding for safe routes to school and to get around some of the bad decisions that we made in the 70s and 80s around highways and expansions and lack of sidewalk infrastructure in a lot of communities. We feel this in Milwaukee. I mean, it's just there are whole stretches of major corridors that don't have sidewalks, and kids walk to school in bike lanes with nothing separating them from cars going 40 miles an hour.
People walking down the Milwaukee Expressway, which I hope they don't do. But
they do.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to. There's no other way to get efficiently from point A to point B. So I think when we're talking about transportation investments and infrastructure investments, this is going to provide us with another tool in the toolbox to begin to start to shift and provide resources to our communities.
Well, we're talking this morning on Locus Focus with Karen Power, who's a state representative for Oregon District 41, and Climate Solutions Oregon Director Meredith Connolly about the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, which is going before the state legislature. So in the last part of the show, let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this. First of all, when is this going to be voted on?
Oh, you mean by us?
Yeah, by you, yes.
I was like, it's referred to the voters? Or?
Well, I hope we don't get to that point. But
Well, we have a short session coming up. What that means is we have about 5 weeks to pass bills back and forth between the chambers, and it really only gives us about a week or so to deliberate on things. This bill is going to be starting as a Senate committee bill, and it's also introduced on the House side as a personal bill for our chair of our Energy and the Environment Committee, Representative Ken Helm, represents Beaverton. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to be able to sign on to the bill and show my support, but I believe the Senate is going to be taking up some of the deliberations. There are some nuanced policy decisions we're still working through with stakeholders, and I don't think we have time to probably jump into those nitty-gritty points. But our hope is to work through those in the next few weeks, make adjustments and amendments as necessary, and then have an opportunity to hopefully vote on it before the beginning of March, before we adjourn.
So do you think there's a better chance this time that it's actually going to reach the floor than it did last year? I mean, I'm wondering about the differences between why did it get stymied last year and what do you hope in a short session to be able to accomplish this year?
I don't think it was stymied at all last session. We spent the majority of the session continuing to deliberate and study the issues and get feedback and reports from our state agencies. A few of us went down to meet with legislators in California and understand some of the policy decisions that they made. And we were really still in study, learn, refinement mode. We issued a bill at the very end of session, so we had something publicly to continue to chew on. But, you know, with the amount of time we spent in joint committee meetings, there was never any expectation that we were going to pass it to the floor and vote on it. It wasn't ready yet for prime time.
But you think this year it is?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific bill. Feel free to jump in, Meredith, but we're ready.
Yeah, and I'm not a legislator, but it kind of feels like the 2017 legislative session never ended because it went straight from issuing this bill at the end of session with 33 legislative co-sponsors, over a third of the legislature. Governor Kate Brown came out and said she supported it. We've seen it prioritized by many legislators stepping forward and saying, we need to do something on climate. This is ready to go. And then it went into a work group process where there was all fall. There were, as I had mentioned before, hundreds of stakeholders all coming in, really chewing on how do we fine tune those last details and really tailor this to Oregon? What makes Oregon different? What do we need to make sure works for here? And what we saw come out of that were amendments, and that's the bill we're looking at now. So it's been a year of legislative process at this point, and I think it's tied up, you know, with a bow on it and ready to go at the beginning of session here.
Now, how is the money that is raised through the auction, how is that specifically going to help Oregon?
So I can pull up our pricing discussions. So where we landed is that the industrial emitters, the auction proceeds there, are going to land in the Climate Investment Fund. 15% of that will go to a Just Transition Fund to help with workforce training and other transitions, other educational opportunities.
So for people who work in the fossil fuel sector right now, who might be losing their jobs, or
not just necessarily. I think it's going to be run through our higher education experts and our workforce experts, so that they can help with a variety of different sectors that are seeing pressures from both climate change and automation and just transitions in the way that our economy grows.
Out of those coal miners in Oregon.
Right.
That's one thing, Lucy, you don't have to worry about.
It's true.
We do hear stories coming from Southern Oregon and from out in Pendleton, who has the most solar panels per capita, which is, I think, a fun surprise. But there isn't that pipeline of workers to install all of that solar on the rooftops right now. They have to bring in workers from other states. So it should be Oregonians getting those jobs and that training, and this infuses money into community colleges and other training programs in addition to supporting workers in fossil fuel.
I mean, as I was looking at the things, that the 3 points that this policy is going to do, and it looked to me like it's partly written by, you know, the leftist environmentalists. I mean, the idea of Just Transition, which is becoming more mainstream, it was a very radical notion a few years ago. So I'm wondering how did that become front and center in this, and is there meaning that there's a real seismic shift in Oregon politics?
Because I think we're seeing changes in sectors that are happening irrespective of the word environment. You know, we're seeing changes around automation and jobs. That from a financial perspective makes sense for those companies to move towards. And as the nature of employment changes, we need to be prepared as a state that and giving opportunities to people to learn new skills, new trades, and supporting some of these educational opportunities that we've heard companies right now say they need workers for.
Now, you made a sort of a joking allusion to the possibility of this being referred to the voters as we're doing right now with Measure 101. Mm-hmm. So first of all, do you think there's a chance that there's going to be that much opposition amongst the minority who votes against the bill that they would refer to the voters? And if so, how would you counter the argument that would be made in the ballot initiative campaign that this is going to cost the ratepayers in Oregon and cost consumers in Oregon money because it's basically a tax?
So I didn't grow up in a state with an initiative and referral system. It sounds like you didn't either. It is.
No, I've been living here for 47 years. I didn't know. I grew up in Massachusetts, not that far from you. So I know it was the initiative process here was a real. They have them all over the country now, but it started here. Mm-hmm. But it's rather disconcerting that like really good legislative. Acts are passed by the legislature, and then they get referred to the voters, and then they get voted down because it's really easy to put a lot of misinformation out in a ballot initiative campaign.
Here's why I think it's a better idea for us to do this through the legislative process. First is we know voters overwhelmingly support a clean energy transition. There's been polling, but we also know through outreach, and my goodness, people in my district tell me this all the time. I think that's true of my colleagues around the state as well. We recognize that climate change is real, regardless of whether our federal government decides to acknowledge it or not. And we want to be doing something proactive about it in a way that's not going to continue harming our communities. And with that backdrop, and knowing that we do have voter support for it and constituent support for it, it's how do we create the best policies that position Oregon to succeed? And I feel pretty strongly that this bill, with the massive amount of feedback, the 12 work group meetings we've had over the last 6 months, is well well fine-tuned in order to help Oregon move forward in a way that aligns with our sister states and with Canada to help grow our economy and do right by our environment here that we cherish.
And I think the other backdrop is, of course, as these fossil fuel interests start to control our federal government more and more, I think people have really realized, you know, it's on us here in the States to be the leaders and to show how we can do this in a way that grows our economy and really weans us off of fossil fuels and invests in clean energy. And so if Oregon can set that model and join this regional movement, that's probably the highest level we can be at. If we join California, Ontario, and Quebec in the Western Climate Initiative, we're the fourth largest economy in the world, putting that price on pollution and investing here in Oregon. So I think that is very meaningful right now in particular.
But you still haven't answered the question, is this going to cost the citizens of Oregon extra money? Because that's always one of the red mm-hmm. herrings that's thrown out mm-hmm. as a reason to defeat an initiative like this.
So in the new version of the bills that we've introduced, as I mentioned earlier, the allowances for our utilities that are transitioning to coal for that specific part are going to be freely given. To the extent that they choose to sell allowances into the auction system rather than engaging in direct reductions, those funds must be used first and foremost for on-bill assistance and reducing consumer bills. First for low-income consumers, and then to a larger scale, the other entities that need to use power every day. So our hope is that through this mechanism, we'll be able to start to get at the problem of carbon emissions and climate change, but not see that sort of rate impact on our bills every month.
Well, I want to end with something you might think is unrelated, but it's big on my mind, which is what's going to happen with Jordan Cove? Is the legislature going to, or Cape Brown, going to make any strong steps to stop any future development of, or any possible development of LNG terminals or methanol refinery like the one that's proposed near Kalatskanai? And I wonder, do you see, as you're trying to get this bill passed, that would be really creating a clean energy future for Oregon, the contradiction between doing that and allowing LNG and methanol refineries to be built in the state?
So I mentioned earlier, I have been a nonprofit environmental attorney since I graduated from law school, and I have a number of friends who do great work in the environmental activism field. And I know they and the community are always looking for ways to stop what they see as bad things from happening. The conversation we've been having around this bill is separate. It is how to begin positioning Oregon to attack and address climate change here at home. I think, as Meredith said earlier, there is no single bullet solution. And as we're seeing around the country, there will continue to be proposals for energy export facilities. So I appreciate that there are folks who want these things to be intertwined, but I think from our intents and purposes this session or to work on this bill, it is not to be confused with those other larger policy questions.
Because I know that, I mean, Portland has successfully banned these kind of facilities from being built here, and there are other cities that are trying to follow in that road. And unfortunately, the bill, the initiative in Coos County last year was, from what I understand, really badly written. That did not address the real problem of that they were facing with Jordan Cove LNG terminal. But it seems like that it does have to be wound in, that there's going to be this ultimate contradiction between really trying to cut Oregon's climate greenhouse gas emissions at the same time that we're not finding stringent ways to keep these projects from not being built. So I just wonder how...
I think from climate solutions perspective, as we look at the science and how things are accelerating faster than we ever predicted, we know we need to keep more fossil fuels in the ground. We also need to be focusing, though, on how do we bring clean energy opportunities to these communities. I think that's been a challenge in the past, too. Climate Solutions has been very active in the Power Past Coal Coalition, who wanted to make sure that the Northwest didn't become a export ground zero for all the coal going out to China and other places. And what we found was these communities said, give us something else to say yes to. You know, this it's this or nothing right now. We need these reinvestments. And while this is separate, what I think is really a key focus of it and why it's called a cap and invest system is really a focus on the investments, on those clean energy jobs. How do you really, that will be, I think, the responsibility of the legislature and those of us who are pushing to pass this legislation is to make sure the proof's in the pudding and that there are reinvestments and there are new opportunities flowing to all of these communities that are not seeing that right now and turn that trend around. So that's on us and a real responsibility that we feel working with labor communities and others around the state. To make sure.
Great. Well, this is a conversation we can continue. Again, maybe somewhere down the line, we'll talk a little bit more about the issues about gas.
That would be great.
I think the Power Pass Gas campaign is going to, you know, is the next thing on the horizon. But I want to thank you both for joining me. It's been a very interesting conversation, and keep us posted about what happens with this bill. We've been talking this morning with Oregon State Representative Karen Power and Climate Solutions Oregon Director Meredith Connolly, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with journalist Adam Fetterman about some scary things happening in the United States Department of the Interior. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Hamza Aldeen, Wish. Thanks for listening.